The last time we talked to a group pushing to end Ohio's property tax, they said they weren't revealing how many signatures they had. Now that number is out. Is it enough to make the November ballot? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our regional politics show, we discuss whether Axe Ohio Tax can meet a July 1st deadline. Plus, the first major candidate to announce a run for Kentucky governor in 2027. And in Indiana, are Republicans who voted against redistricting feeling the heat from President Trump in their primary races? Joining me now to talk about the biggest political news in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Thanks for being here, Karen.
Always glad to be here. Thanks.
Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Happy to be here.
And WFYI government reporter Ben Thorpe. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Hi, excited to be here.
Glad to have you all. We really appreciate it. Karen, this group that's been collecting signatures for a ballot measure that would eliminate property taxes in Ohio gave a recent update. What did they have to say?
Well, the group did their update on a live stream from a house in Lake County that features a replica of the Oval Office, complete with the Resolute Desk that the president sits behind. And they made this announcement that while they need 413,487 valid signatures, they right now have 305,000. And so they feel they are on track to get to that 414,000-ish number, but not to their goal of 620,000. Now, it's important to note that just because you gather 414,000 signatures, that doesn't mean you've made the ballot. They all have to be valid. They have to be registered voters. You can't have more than one person as a registered voter in that pack. You know, they all have to be verified. So that's why I feel like I think it's a good chance that they will not make this year's ballot because they simply don't have enough time. They have to do this number by July 1st in half of Ohio's counties. And that's a very tall order for a group that's all volunteers.
Sure. And that's why they had this goal of getting so many more than the number they needed, right? Because with these initiatives and these signature gathering petitions, a lot of these signatures end up getting thrown out, right?
Right. And in fact, when you look at over the last decade or so, there have been three citizen-initiated constitutional amendments that made the ballot. Redistricting in 2024, that citizens not politicians thing. Reproductive rights and abortion access in 2023. And criminal justice reform in 2018. They all did make the ballot, but they all submitted over 700,000 signatures. And all three of those efforts used paid signature gatherers. And that's a really big difference here in that the group that's working on the property tax abolishment amendment is all volunteer. So it's really difficult to make the ballot without some sort of professional help at this point.
It does, though, Karen, seem like they've collected a lot of signatures without having those professional signature gathering people. I mean, what do you think that says about how Ohio residents are feeling about this issue?
Well, I should note that they've been gathering signatures for almost a year. They got the go-ahead last May. So they've been doing this for a while, and they have been doing it across the state. They say that they have the requisite 44 counties that they have signatures from, and you have to get a certain number of signatures in each of those counties, and it's all based on the last vote for governor in Ohio. And so that's where the 413,487 number comes from. But they say they have 305,000. I'm not sure if they do have 305,000 valid signatures or even, you know, that there are repeats. I've seen people in their Facebook group talk about signing petitions more than once, which that doesn't count. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of passion and interest on the part of these folks and on the part of a lot of taxpayers who really are struggling. They don't understand why property taxes have soared so much. They're concerned about how to pay these property tax bills if they keep going up. So there's definitely a lot of interest here. But I think making the ballot with a constitutional amendment is a totally different animal than being concerned, wanting to talk to lawmakers, wanting to see legislation move through.
Well, even with this uncertainty about whether this group will make the ballot, another group has formed to fight this effort. Tell us about them.
Well, that was completely to be expected, that if indeed the abolish the property tax folks made the ballot, there was going to be a huge response from all of the entities that benefit from property taxes. You're talking about local governments, local officials, even state officials, those who are represented of unions, teachers, law enforcement, first responders. In Ohio, we have taxes, property taxes fund libraries and zoos and services for young children and the elderly. I mean, there's so many things here. And so there was a coalition of more than 65 different groups that came together from that, put together by some very experienced people in terms of running statewide ballot issues. And they were going to push back hard. It's a group called Ohioans to Protect Public Service. Ohioans to Protect Public Services. And, they jumped this announcement from the property tax folks by about a week, saying, we're out here, we're going to be committed to educating people on what really will happen if indeed Ohioans vote to abolish property taxes and eliminate two-thirds of the funding that goes to all of those public services. And, you know, we're talking about $21.4 billion that local governments raise through property taxes for those services. So there was always going to be a really big pushback, and it started already even before they made their announcement.
Karen, what's next with this? Is this a matter of waiting until July 1st to see if, you know, where this group stands with in terms of the signatures they collect?
Well, the Committee to Abolish Property Taxes, as it's known, they also call themselves Axe Ohio Tax. They say that they're going to make a decision mid-June on whether they will submit the signatures they have and hope they make the ballot, or whether they will continue on with their signature gathering and try to make next year's ballot. If they submit the signatures that they have on July 1st, and they don't make the ballot, that's it. They have to start all over again. They can keep the signatures that they've gathered already and move forward if they don't submit them, and they would, again, be aiming for next fall's ballot. So they're going to make that decision, they say, sometime in mid-June. But I still maintain that it's going to be very, very difficult for them to come even close to that 413,487 valid signatures number with the little time they have left.
We're talking about regional politics for the full hour today. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Well, Sylvia, let's talk about what state lawmakers have been doing in Kentucky. They wrapped up a 60-day session in Frankfort earlier this month. Probably feels like just yesterday to you. What were the highlights of the last 2 days of the session? I know those can get pretty hectic.
Yes, fairly hectic. It's not nearly as hectic as really the days before that, because those last 2 days are no longer veto proof. What that means is that any bills that lawmakers pass in those last 2 days, they are subject to the governor's veto and they won't have a chance to come back. They're constitutionally limited to come back if the governor decides to do anything. But really what you see in those last 2 days is a lot of cleanup bills, and you can tell what negotiations were happening behind the scenes in the week that preceded while the governor was having his veto period. So, you know, you see changes to budget bills. You see a lot of Christmas tree legislation coming in. Those are bills that have a lot of ornaments to them. So a lot of things on different topics like tax credits, things like that. And we also saw a lot of discussion about impeachment powers. That was because the Supreme Court had ruled that lawmakers could not proceed with an impeachment that they had started against a Lexington judge because they took issue with some of her judicial decision-making. The Supreme Court's halted them on that. Lawmakers had a lot of discussion over that in those final 2 days because they feel that their power, that the Constitution solely gives that power to the legislature and that the Supreme Court has no bearing on that. So those issues really took over those last 2 days. And then also really notable in the final 2 days that I follow closely is the things that don't pass, the things that we've been talking about all legislative session, but don't come up. So an example of that would be this omnibus housing bill that we were all really expecting to come in those final 2 days. They've been talking about that all session. Really, we've been talking about for years the housing crisis and the housing shortages that we're seeing in the state and really all across the country. But that did not come through in the final hours of the session.
Hmm. Well, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear is a Democrat, of course. The state House and Senate are held by Republican supermajorities. You mentioned that veto period. Did the governor issue any major vetoes?
He definitely did a lot of just general vetoes, and also on some appropriations bills, he gave line item vetoes. Essentially, all of those were overridden. There were a few small ones in the giant budget bill, some line item vetoes that they allowed to stand. But all of his large vetoes, they overrode within a day. So that includes legislation dealing with firearms, you know, especially one that allowed younger Kentuckians, so older teens, to get permits for concealed carry. You know, there's just a lot of bills that Beshear took issue with, and they overrode basically all of his vetoes there.
Well, you mentioned Christmas tree bills, those kind, that legislation that ends up with so much stuff kind of piled on top of it. Was there a big Christmas tree bill at the very end of this session? Were there any surprises in that?
There were a few, and you know, there's always a lot of surprises, and unfortunately, because they come in so close to the end of the legislative day, I often as a reporter, and also some lawmakers I know, don't have time to read them all the way through before they are asked to vote on them. So we saw a lot of tons of last minute tax credits. I'm talking economic development, mixed use development, alternative jet fuel tax credits. There was more exemptions to the state's inheritance tax. We saw some cleanup from a previous, another giant bill. This was a gambling bill that Beshear vetoed and they overrode, but they had some cleanup language to that. There was a lot of different things that get packed into these bills. You also, like I was saying, you see some of the results of negotiations over the last few days before they come back for this last kind of sweep of legislation. They returned a lot of funding that had been cut from universities. For example, there had been some reductions across the board at several of our state universities. A lot of that funding was returned within the last couple days of session in one of those giant Christmas tree bills.
Well, Ben, Indiana lawmakers, they finished their legislative session earlier this year. I know redistricting was the big story there. Remind us what state lawmakers did in Indiana and what President Trump wanted them to do.
Yeah, so the reason that we finished early this year is because lawmakers came in December to do this redistricting push, or to be part of redistricting. And essentially, you know, a lot of our lawmakers are worried about, you know, being very frugal. And there were a lot of concerns that if they had a special session in December, it was going to cost something like $300,000. And so they decided that the December session was part of the normal 2026 session. And so that's why, our session as a whole was cut short. But basically, you know, Trump has been pushing across the country for states to redistrict. He's worried that we're headed into the midterms here and Republicans could lose the House, the U.S. House. And so he's been calling for a lot of states to redistrict in order to kind of cut out some of these seats. And here in Indiana, a bunch of our lawmakers were kind of reticent to do that. Our senators initially refused even to come in to decide this issue. And then after immense pressure over a couple of months, came in and ultimately voted against redistricting, which I think came as a big surprise, especially for, you know, I think a lot of the national people who came in to cover redistricting were like, oh, of course this is going to go through. After all of this, this is going to happen. And, you know, when the final vote came out, about 21 Republicans here in the Indiana Senate said that they were opposed. And so it ultimately failed.
Well, because Indiana also has Republican supermajorities in the state House. Are some of those Republicans who voted against this redistricting plan, are they now facing primary challenges? I guess I wonder if they're feeling the heat that over defying the president, essentially.
Yeah. And, you know, Trump and our Governor Mike Braun both threatened that there was going to be consequences for taking this vote. They basically said, look, we are going to put some weight behind primary challenges. We've got about 8 senators here in the state who are up for re-election that voted against redistricting. All 8 of them are facing primary challengers right now, and the thrust of those challenges is over this redistricting vote that they took. I think what's been kind of incredible to see is how involved the Trump administration has gotten in some of these, I think, ultimately very local races. One that really stands out, we have a Senator Greg Good, who is facing a primary challenger, Brenda Wilson, who has been endorsed by the president. But there was another primary challenger, Alexandra Wilson, who kind of got involved in the race and was challenging Greg Good and saw a huge push from the White House for her to fall out of the race. She ultimately released a Google Drive that was full of all of these calls and text messages that she got from both, White House officials and some Republicans here in the state, all urging her to drop out because they didn't want kind of to split the ticket here and have votes going to Alexandra Wilson and Brenda Wilson and allowing Greg Good, who voted against redistricting, ultimately to survive. And so anyway, this Google Drive of all of these things just, I think, shows how involved the president is in trying to get rid of these senators who stood against him, basically.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that Governor Mike Braun had threatened to back primary challengers, too. Has he weighed in on any of those races?
Yeah, so he has weighed in on the races and, has stood with the president on all of the Senate races and said, all right, I'm backing the challengers in all of these districts where we have a senator who voted for against redistricting. But what's interesting is he's not doing the same things for some of our lawmakers in the House. We have a handful of lawmakers in the House, Republicans, who voted against redistricting there. Now, redistricting did ultimately pass the Indiana House by a pretty sizable margin, but he is showing support there for some of the lawmakers who opposed redistricting. And then, when it comes to the Senate, he is backing primary challengers for all of the lawmakers there. So I think it's showing kind of an interesting split in terms of where people's allegiances lie on this issue, depending on where you are.
Well, Ben, I have to ask you about this because I know a lot of people have been following this big issue during the session, this effort to lure the Chicago Bears to Indiana. Where does all that stand now?
Yeah, so we are right now in the midst of a holding pattern. I think there's a question about what's going to happen next year. Indiana, obviously, our legislative session ended early, and so we passed this bill that was aimed at attracting the Bears to come to Indiana, our big kind of funding bill for the Bears. There was a lot of pomp and circumstance, and, I have a couple friends who are reporters up in Chicago, and From the get-go, they're like, this is not going to happen. Don't get too excited. The Bears are not coming to Indiana. And so it was interesting when they, our lawmakers passed that bill. They held this really celebratory press conference. And if you were listening to the language that they were using, it sounded like they were basically like, this is a done deal. The Bears are coming to Indiana. Obviously, Illinois is still moving through its legislative session. They just passed their version of the Keep the Bears bill there. And so right now we're waiting to hear what's going to happen. And I will say, again, because I have friends who are up there who are covering this, they're saying things like, I think they're sounding less certain right now. And I think there is a real shot that the Bears might end up coming to Indiana.
Wow. Okay, well, we will continue our regional politics show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with the regional politics show. My guests are Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman, WFYI government reporter Ben Thorpe, and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. You can join the conversation. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Let's talk about the big U.S. Senate races on the ballot this year. Sylvia, tell us about the Republicans who are facing off in the primary for the seat that Senator Mitch McConnell currently holds.
Right. So obviously big shoes to fill here with Senator Mitch McConnell leaving office. We have really three Republicans that who have dominated this race thus far. Lexington businessman Nate Morris, current representative Andy Barr, U.S. Representative Andy Barr, and former Attorney General Daniel Cameron, who some might also recognize from his unsuccessful bid for the governorship in 2023. So those are the top three. There's also a fourth candidate who has far less money than the other three, Michael Ferris, but he has also kind of been getting himself out there. And those really, this race has been quite interesting to follow. All three have somewhat similar issues that they're campaigning on, but a very different monetary kind of backing.
Well, tell us about those issues. What are the big issues really defining this race?
I guess the big issues would be immigration, diversity, anti-diversity, equity and inclusion. You know, they've been have been asked at least a lot about the Iran war, you know, defending Trump's economy. But that really just all boils down to support of President Trump. All three pretty much across the board support President Trump unequivocally. And that has really dominated this race. I mean, just watching the campaign ads, it's pretty clear that is the main discussion of who supports Trump the best.
Well, you mentioned money. How expensive has this primary been and who's paying for it?
I mean, predictably, it's an expensive primary, right? We're talking about a Senate race here, $48 million in this primary. The vast majority of that, the majority, I should say, has gone to Morris at $28 million. That includes both PAC and, candidate money raised, $19 million to Barr. And then Cameron is lagging significantly with just over $1 million, which is not a lot when it comes to a Senate race. And really, a lot of that money has come from these giant dark money PACs and billionaires, too. And, you know, billionaire funding PACs. Really, a lot of that has come from Morris. Morris has raised a lot of money, or at least there's a lot of PACs that have raised money to support Morris. We're talking about money from Elon Musk, hedge fund managers, oil and gas billionaires, Jeff Yass. I mean, so we're talking about a lot of big names nationally, a lot of PAC money coming in here. But I would be remiss if I didn't note that that has not lined up directly with polling that's come out. Morris has still lagged a lot, even though he's far more funding that he's been able to secure. But Barr has and Cameron are really battling for first place, according to at least all the polls that we've seen so far. Cameron, you know, had a great big lead over the other two to start out with. That has significantly shrunk. Some polls are showing Barr pulling ahead of him in some places, but it's really been a pretty tight polling scenario, considering the fact that Cameron has lagged so far behind in fundraising.
Yeah. Has President Trump endorsed any of these candidates?
Very notably, no. President Trump has not weighed in on the Senate primary. Obviously, those in Northern Kentucky will know he is not shying away from weighing in on other congressional races. But in the Senate primary, he has not. When he came to campaign in Kentucky for Ed Gallerine in Northern Kentucky, he very notably said each of the candidates' names and did not endorse any of the three.
That's right. Yeah, he certainly endorsed Ed Gallerine, the opponent for Congressman Thomas Massie here in Northern Kentucky. Well, yes. Sylvia, I know there's kind of a crowded Democratic primary, too. Who's running there?
Yeah, we have a crowded race up there. Charles and some familiar names as well. Charles Booker, Amy McGrath, a less known, a first-time candidate, Dale Romans, who's a Louisville horse trainer, and then a state representative, Pam Stevenson. She's the only current elected official in that list. But like I said, Charles Booker and Amy McGrath, they have both run Senate campaigns before, and they are running here again. Charles Booker seems to be kind of towards the forefront of that pack, but it's a pretty crowded race, and I think a lot of people are looking out for who could challenge a Republican in this Senate race.
Well, Karen, I know there's a Democratic primary for U.S. Senate in Ohio, too. Who's running aside from former Senator Sherrod Brown? He's the one we hear so much about.
Well, you might be one of the few people in Ohio who knows there's a Democratic primary. Sherrod Brown, obviously a former U.S. senator, wants to go back to the U.S. Senate. He certainly has the advantage here. There were, I think, six other candidates who had dropped out of the race, potentially running against him, but there's one still remaining. His name is Ron Kincaid. He's a first-time candidate, and he's definitely fighting an uphill battle against Sherrod Brown, who's clearly looking down the road to face current U.S. Senator John Husted in the fall.
And that's the big assumption, that Sherrod Brown is going to be facing Senator Husted, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to predict, but.
How expensive do you think this race is going to get?
It's going to get very expensive. It could very well be the most expensive U.S. Senate race in the country, if not one of the most expensive. I mean, already Sherrod Brown comes into this race with a big cash advantage over Husted. Brown raised $10.1 million in the first quarter of the year. Husted raised $2.9 million. But that is just, that's only a drop in the bucket compared to the money that they will both bring into the race, not only from themselves, you know, the money they'll raise, but also parties. The parties will be raising, and then the outside forces that are going to come in. I mean, Sherrod Brown got into this race because he had been encouraged to by Minority Leader Chuck Schumer in the U.S. Senate. And so that it certainly suggests that we will see a lot of Democratic national money coming in. And then, of course, Republicans want to hang on to this seat. And so they'll be putting a lot of money behind Husted. And then you start mixing all the dark money in there, and it's going to get very, very expensive. It could easily top $500 million.
Wow.
Well, it was $300 million in 2024 when Bernie Moreno beat Sherrod Brown. So there's no reason to expect that it's not going to at least be that.
Sure. I mean, inflation, right?
Well, and also Sherrod Brown is in a unique position in that he's one of the few former senators who's trying to return. He lost his election 2 years ago, but wants to come back and thinks he's got a serious shot. Polls are showing that the race is very competitive, though I don't put a whole lot of stock in polls right now. But obviously, John Husted appointed to the U.S. Senate to replace J.D. Vance when he became vice president. He's got a lot of Republican support. Republicans have been really united going into this primary. There is a Republican primary for governor, and that's gotten kind of interesting. But for the most part, Republicans have really stayed united behind the candidates that they've endorsed.
We're talking about regional politics today for the full hour. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Karen, you mentioned the race for governor, and Republican Vivek Ramaswamy recently released an attack ad against Democratic candidate Dr. Amy Acton.
Nobody ever cast a vote for Amy Acton, but she stopped yours. Acton called off Ohio's election at the last minute, defying a judge's orders and abusing her power. Now, Acton wants to be our governor. We already gave her a chance. Ohio can't afford liberal Amy Acton. Vivek Ramaswamy.
Karen, tell us more about that ad. What's it talking about?
Well, I definitely want to come back to the primary that Ramaswamy is going to be he's running in.
Sure.
That happens next week. But this ad, this is the first real attack ad we've seen, and it shows that Ramaswamy is already looking down the road at Amy Acton, the former director of the Ohio Department of Health, who will be his Democratic opponent in the fall. And this ad has some real questionable statements in here. That whole idea, it's really playing on what people remember from the pandemic in 2020, and how the primary that was set for St. Patrick's Day in 2020 had been, the polls were closed the day before, because that was when everything was hitting in terms of the virus and the lockdowns and all of that. And Amy Acton did sign the health order that did close the polls, but as Governor Mike DeWine has said, she did that at his direction, and that he spoke with John Husted, who was then Lieutenant Governor, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, and also the chairs of the Ohio Republican and Ohio Democratic parties, to make sure that closing the polls in 2020 would be okay because of the pandemic, and extending that early voting period all the way till April 28th is when it ended up being extended to. But DeWine has been really clear that Amy Acton didn't make that decision on her own, that he made the decision. She signed the order at his direction because she was his health director. And so there have been some real questions raised about the accuracy of that ad. And my colleague Joe Ingles did a story, a kind of a fact checking of that, playing some old tape from 2020 showing that, yeah, this is a decision that was made by DeWine, LaRose, Husted, and Republican leaders. And though Amy Acton's signature is on that health order, those Republicans were key players, if not the decision makers.
Well, you wanted to come back to the Republican primary in the race for governor. Mm-hmm. Do you think anybody's going to give Ramaswamy a fight?
Well, the race was a three-way race at one point until Heather Hill, one of the three candidates, she and her running mate, former running mate now, Stuart Motes, got into a public tiff on social media, and all sorts of accusations went back and forth. And so Motes did a video saying that he was withdrawing his name from the ballot, and Heather Hill said she was going to replace him, which she can't do. So she is no longer a candidate for governor in Ohio, and any votes for her in Ohio on Tuesday will not count. So that leaves Vivek Ramaswamy and Casey Putsch, who is a Northwest Ohio car designer, innovator, who's said some really problematic things on social media about Ramaswamy's heritage. And it's really gotten to a very ugly place in terms of commenters really bringing up Ramaswamy being of Indian heritage. And he's Hindu, though he's been endorsed by the head of the Center for Christian Virtue in Ohio. And it's just gotten really, really ugly. So this is a primary that I'm sure Ramaswamy wants to put behind him as soon as possible.
Hmm. Well, we do have a caller on the line. Hi, Robert. Thank you for listening. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking me. My name is Robert, and I heard that the three candidates for Senate in the Republican race in Kentucky were all kind of on the same page with Trump, and I wanted to know what the stance on was with Thomas Massie, who is a figure in northern Kentucky. He has taken some chances against Trump, and is that something at all in the race's discussion?
Interesting. Thank you. Sylvia, what about that? Have you heard the three leading Senate candidates, Republicans in Kentucky, talk much about Congressman Massie or any of the things he's championed, like the Epstein files?
Yeah, he's definitely come up. I need to double check if all of them. I know Nate Morris has definitely endorsed Ed Gowrine. I believe Andy Barr has as well. I'm not sure about Daniel Cameron. But yes, he's definitely come up, especially he recently came up at a debate over the Iran war. And I think, you know, with them saying that Thomas Massie wasn't supporting, Donald Trump's agenda enough in that arena when he, you know, tried to pass war powers resolutions to limit President Trump in Iran. So, yes, that race has come up. Daniel Cameron, for example, has been endorsed by some other more Northern Kentucky Liberty candidates, thinking of like Representative Savannah Maddox in Northern Kentucky, some other more Liberty aligned individuals. To be short, while they all have, you know, kind of expressed unequivocal support for Donald Trump, Thomas Massie has been less of a discussion point. But I think that when it comes down to it, at least some of the candidates would pick Ed Gowrine over Thomas Massie because of that support.
Have any of those candidates answered questions about what they think about the release of the Epstein files? That was something that Congressman Massie championed, for a very long time. The president was initially against that, but ultimately signed the bill that allowed for that release. I don't know if that's mm-hmm. been an issue.
You know, I'm trying to remember the last time that came up at an event I was at. And I do think that they have mentioned it before. I think the general response that I've heard from candidates is, well, the president did sign it and he did release them. So that's their answer, right? Like that they kind of stand where President Trump is on this, that, well, they released the files. What more do you want is kind of the response I've heard thus far.
I see. Well, Ben, there's no gubernatorial race in Indiana this year, but I gotta feel like Governor Braun had to win some big popularity points when he paused the state's gas tax. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think that's an open question, at least for me. There's been a lot of talk about affordability this year here at the State House. Both Republicans and Democrats have made a big deal of trying to draw down costs for Hoosiers. But after session wrapped up, I think you heard people on both sides of the aisle saying, did we do enough to make Indiana more affordable? It's been really interesting going to especially some of the like ceremonial bill signings, because you're hearing lawmakers say, we wish we could have gone further. Things didn't get done that we wanted to get done. Things aren't going to get that much cheaper. And so around those conversations, I think when the war in Iran was kicking off, you heard reporters asking, hey, we're seeing gas prices go up. Will you be willing to kind of pause those, or pause the gas tax rather? And initially, one of the governor's press people sent out a thing and reminded everybody that there's a gas tax and there's an excise tax. The excise tax is about 36 cents, I think, on a gallon. The gas tax is about 17 cents. And he said, look, we can't get rid of the excise tax. That would be like the big help here. And the gas tax itself, I think at 17 cents, is not a big deal. And you've heard a lot of pundits, at least here in Indianapolis, arguing that it would be a mistake to continue to do this. I think it's costing the state for the first 30 days that the governor has extended this, about $50 million. And so I think there's a question of, is it worth it to the state to pause this thing, given the fact that, at the pump, I'm not sure that this is something that the average person is really noticing.
Huh. How much longer does that pause last? You mentioned the 30-day pause. Are we getting close to the end of that?
Yeah, we're coming up on the end of the first 30-day pause. By law, the governor can do it for about 60 days. Before he needs legislative approval. But obviously, our legislature is not in session. And I think a lot of people have already kind of said it doesn't really make sense to call everybody into session just to vote on the issue of this gas tax. The governor has indicated to a couple of outlets here that he would be interested in extending at least until the full 60 days. We're going to find out here probably in the next 2 weeks whether or not that's going to happen.
Okay. Well, we will be back after a short break to wrap up our regional politics show. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our regional politics show. My guests are WFYI government reporter Ben Thorpe, Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call, 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. I want to talk about some of the issues that all three states are grappling with and have in common, starting with data centers. Ben, I know this is an issue Indiana state lawmakers tried to tackle earlier this year during that very short session. What can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, I think the big answer is not much. And I want to take a moment and just shout out, I was not covering the ins and outs of data centers this session. We have two reporters here at WFYI who've been covering data centers. So big shout out to Zach Kessel and Farah Anderson, who have been doing a lot of the both local and statewide coverage on that issue. Basically, lawmakers were looking to see if it was possible to incentivize locals to pick up and say yes to some of these data centers. A lot of our local jurisdictions here in Indiana, and I think across the country, are becoming increasingly skeptical about being the host site for a data center. And you have a lot of people in the public who are really concerned about bringing one to an area, particularly when it comes to energy costs. One of the things that lawmakers kind of looked at was, okay, can we make it so that a data center is going to pay a percent of what they're paying in their energy costs to the township or the city or the county that they're coming to? And obviously, because a lot of these data centers are paying potentially like millions of dollars in energy costs, that would be a huge boon to that local jurisdiction. Over the course of the kind of short legislative session, that ultimately got watered down. So it was much closer to like a couple hundred thousand dollars as opposed to millions. And so I think a lot of people are saying that's probably not going to be enough to incentivize someone to approve that. The other thing that's been happening is you hear Governor Braun talking increasingly about, look, we're going to hold data centers accountable. We want them to bring 100% of the energy that they need to the grid. This is a part of the deal that he struck with Meta earlier this year. Meta is opening a big data center here in Indiana. And so he's saying, look, this is going to be the part of the deal moving forward. 100% of the energy, either they have to buy energy to bring it to the grid, or you have to, create, I don't know, solar panels, wind, whatever, to help bring that energy to the grid a different way. In the kind of conversations around that, a lot of people have pointed out that there's nothing in the law that's going to require something like that. And so people have basically pressed the governor to be like, would you, support making that a law? And he said he would. So it's unclear if this is something that might get picked up during the next legislative session.
So it sounds like you're hearing that your colleagues are hearing a lot of concern from residents in Indiana, just like we're hearing in Ohio and Kentucky when it comes to data centers.
That's right. I mean, there have been protests across the state. People are really concerned about the cost of energy. Obviously, this last session was this huge issue around utilities and affordability. And so I think people see data centers coming to their area and are really worried about rising costs. We've also seen, as I'm sure you've seen, we had a local city councilor whose house was shot at, and a note was kind of left on the doorstep that said no data centers. Because this is a city councilor who has kind of indicated his support for a potential data center coming to Martindale Brightwood, the neighborhood here in Indianapolis. And so, yeah, I think you're seeing a lot of pushback and a lot of concern and a lot of anger, frankly, around data centers.
Sylvia, I know there's been concern and pushback from Kentucky residents, too, and there was some legislation that lawmakers were considering to protect ratepayers from data centers in Kentucky, but that fell short in Frankfort too. What happened? How come that couldn't get across the finish line?
Right. There are a lot of concurrent kind of protest movements, what have you, around data centers happening right now in Kentucky. And this legislation was meant to address some of the concerns with data centers, ensure that, existing utility customers don't end up subsidizing the major infrastructure investments that would need to happen for data centers to move in. A bill was brought up in the General Assembly. It was bipartisan, filed by a Republican, supported by at least some Democrats. It passed the state house quite easily, but then it stalled out in the Senate. That language was then inserted into another bill, which was stripped out before it made final passage in those last few days. So it had a bit of a difficult journey in the legislature and did not eventually make it to passage.
Didn't the General Assembly pass a bill last year to attract data centers to the state? Wasn't that the feeling last session?
It most certainly did. And most notably, that was championed by Senate leadership. Senator Robert Stivers was really the champion of those incentives. The tax credits are actually older than last year. I believe they were made the year before that, if not earlier, but they were significantly expanded in 2025. And they were designed to attract more data centers. The idea being that it would be a boon for localities in terms of property taxes. It might create a few jobs along the way too. But there currently are no restrictions or requirements of utility companies when they're making these deals. When I talked to Senator Stivers about why this did not make it across the finish line, he said that they would continue to consider the ideas, but that generally right now they believe that utility companies like Louisville Gas and Electric and Kentucky Utilities, in conjunction with the Public Service Commission, which is kind of the utility regulator in the state, that they've come up with the structure of tariffs and the rate structure that they've set up for data centers is good enough at this time and that they don't need to get involved as a legislature.
Karen, doesn't Ohio have tax incentives for data centers too?
Well, I just moderated a discussion about data centers in front of the Columbus Metropolitan Club last week, and there was a lot of discussion about that. Ohio, the state doesn't really have a whole lot of tax incentives for data centers, but local communities do, and there's also a tax break, a sales tax break for data centers when they're buying the construction materials they need to build those data centers, which is huge. That's significant. Legislators tried to pull that back. Governor Mike DeWine vetoed that, so it keeps that tax break in place. But data centers have become a huge issue here in Ohio. We are a magnet for data centers. We have over 200 right now, and more are coming, including what may be the planet's largest data center in Piketon on old federal land that used to be the Portsmouth gaseous facilities plant there, a gaseous diffusion plant. There it is. So we've got, and of course, there is a ballot issue potentially. You've got a group of citizens from Southwest Ohio who are really working on gathering signatures to put the question of whether data centers that use more than 25 megawatts monthly should be banned in Ohio. They're gathering those signatures. It's a tall order for them, just like with the property tax folks, but there's definitely a groundswell that's building against data centers, which for a while were seen as, you know, clean development and good jobs and all of that.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that sales tax break is what I was thinking of. I know state lawmakers have introduced some legislation related to data centers in Ohio, too. We talked about a series of bills that Democrats have proposed, a data center study commission favored by some GOP lawmakers. Any progress on any of that, Karen?
Nothing has really come forward yet, but this is really one of those issues that's bipartisan because you see Democrats and Republicans both against these big data centers and for data centers. And it's really kind of changed from, again, what we saw with, you know, going back to Intel just a couple of years ago in Central Ohio and the big splash that made, because again, a lot of folks see this as cleaner development. It's not as intensive as manufacturing, say, but there were some legitimate questions that have been raised about the money that goes into these. And of course, the environmental concerns on not only water, but also air. And then you've got the whole question about whether people are paying in their electric bills for energy that data centers are really pulling away from ratepayers.
Sure. And there's also the question of how much jobs these places really create, isn't there, Karen?
Absolutely. And now the data center industry, you're really seeing them ramp up the campaigns to try to get people's minds to be changed a little bit and go back to being a little more supportive of data centers. They say that these are good jobs, that over time data centers employ more people as they change for the needs of the community. And of course, construction jobs are good jobs, but you know, there's a lot of questions and data centers kind of come into communities that didn't expect them necessarily. And there's not a lot of transparency around these. So sometimes people find out that they're going to be living just down the street from a brand new big data center. It's not what they wanted. And they feel that it's disrupting their environment.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and WFYI Government Reporter Ben Thorpe. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu, and Rob Fetters wrote our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.